5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
G'day, Dr. Carl.
And liftoff.
40 years on, we want to unpack the behind-the-scenes story of the Challenger disaster.
Obviously a major malfunction.
I saw it explode. I couldn't believe it.
Hear the whole story on our podcast, The Challenger Legacy, a new series of science fiction. Search for Science Fiction on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. This is David Rutledge with you once again for a conversation this week about identity, that age-old and perennially vexed question of who am I? The way in which that question is framed has undergone profound change over the centuries. Enlightenment philosophers like Descartes and Locke and Kant thought about the self as something autonomous, something stable and grounded in individual rational consciousness. A little further on in modernity, we find the likes of Hegel and Marx and Freud arguing that the self is still an individual, but radically shaped by social relations and economic structures and unconscious forces. Then, in the late 20th century, we find the self posited as something that emerges through language and culture and shared practices, and identity as something formed with and through others. So, individual identity on one hand, collective identity on the other. And while both these perspectives have certain liberatory potential, there's a lot of tension between them, as we see today in proclamations that radical individualism has turned us all into selfish consumers versus proclamations that identity politics has gone too far, resulting in tribalism and social fragmentation. Well, this week, I'm talking about all this with Lawrence Splitter, whose most recent book is titled Identity, Reasonableness, and Being One Among Others. Lawrence Splitter has had a very interesting career, which we're going to be dipping in and out of. Most recently, he's started a podcast, and we'll hear more about that later in the show. But the other thing you need to know about Lawrence Splitter is that since the early 1980s, he's been a leading figure in the teaching of philosophy in schools, and that's where we began our conversation this week. Now, you've been a pioneer of philosophy for children and the introduction of philosophy into Australian schools. What got you started on that? Like, what was it about the education system in the 1980s that made you think these kids need philosophy?
Yes, well, you're testing my memory here. It was back in the early 1980s. I'd basically just finished a doctorate in philosophy at Oxford, and I was teaching philosophy in an Australian university. And I guess for a long time I'd been really interested in education and felt that philosophy had a role to play, but I wasn't quite sure what that would look like. And then I came across this program called Philosophy for Children, which was started in the United States back in the late 60s, actually. And I thought this really hits, you know, the nail on the head. And so that's what got me into it in the first place. And I basically started to visit some schools. I was in Sydney at that time before I moved back down to Melbourne. I visited some schools. I realized very quickly that I needed to work with teachers because I wasn't a certified teacher. And I needed to also sit down with kids, literally, of different age groups, of primary and also secondary, to really trial this. And so that's what was going on during the 1980s and then into the 1990s. And the more I did it, the more I sort of became committed to it. And perhaps a good way to explain it is to introduce a term which is very much part of philosophy for children, although they originated as separate terms, and that's the idea of treating the classroom as a community of inquiry or a community of dialogue. Because I thought then, and I still do believe, that dialogue, as in, you know, serious, good conversation or powerful conversation, is a really crucial ingredient which is often overlooked in our education system. So that's a bit of it in summary.
Your own philosophical background, I understand, is in analytic philosophy, logic, mathematics. Presumably, that's not what you were bringing to philosophy for children. Did that take you a long way out of your comfort zone?
Well, I was out of my comfort zone in the sense of trying to learn a little bit about pedagogy. In other words, you know, the practice of good teaching. But I wasn't really out of my comfort zone in a philosophical sense because even though philosophy for children, it's in terms of its history and people who founded it, such as Matthew Lipman and Anne Margaret Sharp, they came out of more of what is called a pragmatist tradition in philosophy. But I found it really, for me, quite easy to bring, as you said, the analytic tradition in, because to me that was what constituted good philosophy. It didn't have to be sort of, you know, abstract, dry argumentation about, you know, theses or concepts that no one really cared about. It could indeed be focused on ideas and concepts and questions that children, for example, care a lot about and which have been discussed as part of the philosophical tradition for thousands of years. It just so happens that the tradition I grew up with, which is analytic philosophy, I thought gave me some really good tools to use, and I'm still fairly committed to that because that's the tradition I come out of. So for me, it was not really a problem in that sense.
Mm. What were some of those age-old philosophical issues that children were just sort of intrinsically interested in and presumably still are?
If you think about something as familiar as friendship, you know, you go back to Aristotle and even further back, and I'm thinking now in the Western tradition, you know, Aristotle was very interested in the concept of friendship as a fundamental ethical concept. And it's probably not a surprise for people to think that young children are also interested in friendship, even if they don't talk about it as such. But when you do raise it with them, and in philosophy for children, it often comes via a stimulus such as a story in which the concept of friendship will come up. And then the children talk about, well, what is a friend? You know, what makes someone a friend? And I have this idea or this acronym that I talk about, the three C's. So a concept like friendship could also be fairness or what's real or what the mind is, or space and time, how we know things, what makes something true. All of these, as it were, concepts, they're familiar. So they're common. That's the first C. But it turns out we don't all agree on their meanings. And that's the second C. They're contestable. So they're worth talking about and realizing that we have different perspectives on them. And the third C is that many of them are what I call central. They're important. So for a concept like friendship is really important to most of us, and especially to young kids.
How has the teaching of philosophy in schools changed since the early 1980s, particularly with respect to the challenges that philosophy in schools faced, say, 30, 40 years ago, and how you might compare those challenges to the challenges faced by philosophy in schools today?
Yeah, look, it's a reasonable question. I'm just not sure how well I can answer it. I remember in what I call the early days, you know, in schools, and I'd talk about when I was giving presentations to teachers and workshops and so on, and we'd talk about the need to teach children to be better thinkers, to talk together and listen to each other and so on. And they would often nod their head and say, yes, yes, but of course we do already try to do this. And then I would introduce the term philosophy, and their eyes or some of their eyes would start to glaze over, and they'd think, oh, hang on, why do we have to have this, you know, new sort of rather esoteric subject that hasn't really had a very prominent place in schools before? So we went through all that. And I think now, at least over the, you know, the last 40 or so years in Australia and elsewhere, the idea of bringing philosophy and children together is no longer shocking. Right. I mean, that's one thing that's been achieved. And there are a number of schools now, although not as many as we would like. It goes up and down depending on, you know, teachers and principals and so on, that are really committed to this. So in terms of how things have changed, well, one thing that's happened certainly in Australia and in my state in Victoria is the introduction of philosophy as a senior school subject, like here in VCE, for example. And I had a little bit to do with that, but only a little bit. And that's I won't say that's prominent. It's still a fairly specialised subject. But that has impacted on the idea of doing philosophy at a lower level, at a more junior level. Another thing, while we're on the subject of schooling, and again, I don't want to sound as if I'm an expert on this, but I do get the sense that things in schools and classrooms have become, if anything, even more pressured and conservative in terms of pressure on teachers, parental involvement in what they expect from schools and teachers, all of the outcomes-based learning and so on. And this has made it just a little bit more difficult thinking about something like philosophy, which, I mean, this is a whole topic, right? People would say, well, what in philosophy, you don't have any true answers, which I don't actually agree with. So we can't assess it properly. So it's really, you know, always going to be an outlier. So I think that's still a challenge, and perhaps it will always be a challenge. I think it's part of a broader problem of the way schools and education in this country are heading, and that might be something we want to talk about.
There is, in your recent work, a very interesting focus on identity. And I'm wondering if there's a sort of a conceptual line we can draw that connects your philosophy for children work with this philosophical interest in identity. What's the link there?
Another good question. I think probably the best way to see that, other than that, well, in addition to the fact that the concept of identity is one that I studied all the way through my studies in philosophy, it's a central concept in philosophy and also in analytic philosophy. But even more importantly, I see it as a central concept in this idea of a classroom or a group of people being a community of inquiry. Because I think the issue of identity, how we see ourselves, in particular how we see ourselves as persons, is really important. So, you know, if even a question like, what is it that makes me me, you know, what is my identity, is, I think, worth considering, because it really is related to this issue of personhood. And a really crucial feature of a community of inquiry is that each member of the community sees themselves as persons, but also sees the other members of the community as persons, so that each of them sees themselves as one among others, which is one of my favourite phrases. And that means that it's a balance between seeing ourselves simply as individuals with our own interests and our own ideas and so on, the sort of individualist, subjectivist extreme, and the other extreme being, and something we might want to talk about a bit further, a very strong collectivist idea that I'm part of something bigger, and that bigger thing really defines who I am. And that, I think, can really be a problem when it comes to a person's own sense of self, because they can get swept up or swallowed by the larger group. And there are plenty of examples where that's happening. So that's not the case in a community of inquiry, ideally speaking. It's a relational community. So it's really made up of the people who are in it and the relationships that they form with each other.
You're providing a lovely thumbnail sketch here of your most recent book, which I'd like to get into. This is Identity, Reasonableness and Being One Among Others, came out in 2023. The first thing to maybe talk about here is a distinction that you draw at the outset of the book, and it's a distinction that you're touching on there. It's a familiar distinction among analytic philosophers, but maybe not familiar to our audience. And that's the distinction between what they call numerical and qualitative identity. Tell me about that. What do these two terms signify?
Yeah, this is an important but difficult question to answer, because whilst most of it is, in a sense, obvious in the world of analytic philosophy, it doesn't seem to be obvious outside that. So, for example, in amongst social scientists, and I did a lot of research, you know, in the literature of that, and also in the sort of common view and in the media and so on, if you ask a question like, just ask people, what's your identity? You know, who? What makes you you? They will very often start answering in what I call qualitative terms. In other words, they'll think of features, characteristics, or qualities that they associate themselves with or identify with, such as, you know, well, I'm Australian, I'm Jewish, I'm gay, I'm a male, I'm an academic, or whatever it is. And so the idea would be that you start talking about your identity in terms of these things that you have in common with others. And it seemed to me for a long time that this was going in the wrong direction. If we're trying to pin down what actual identity is, the qualitative direction is really asking, what do I have in common with others? Whereas the question of identity is, what makes me me? What makes me unique or distinctive? So let me give a very trivial example, which I think people can relate to. So I show you an old school photo of mine from, say, my third grade some years ago, and I ask you to find me in that photo. Now, however we might do that, and here's the sort of trick. Someone looking at that photo is bound to use qualitative characteristics. In other words, they're going to try and find someone who does in some sense look like or is similar to me. But the question was not which person in that photo is most similar to me. Because let's face it, you know, 50 or more years ago, none of the people in that photo are similar to me now. The question really is which one in that photo is me. In other words, is strictly identical to me. And that concept of identity, I think it makes sense in an intuitive way. And what we're really asking is, which is the person in that photo who is part of a kind of how shall I say, historical spatio-temporal chain that began with my origins, my birth, if you like, or maybe earlier, and went through to when I was in that primary school photo and then continued for the next X years until here I am now. And that's what makes me me. So it's not a question of having qualitative characteristics. It's a question of what we might call numerical or quantitative identity. And can I just add that the reason that's really important is that we wouldn't be able to make sense of the idea that I have changed in so many ways, physically, mentally, and in other ways, since that photo, unless there was someone or something there that persisted. So it's me who has changed, and that seems to me to be really important and an indicator that we need to think of who I literally am, not in qualitative terms. That's part of it. I need to add, though, if I may, a second part to that, because to think of someone with even an object like a bottle or a phone, but think of persons, people, right? Their identities are not just as individual things. They are also things of a particular kind. So I'm a person, let's say. So that's the kind of thing I am. And the reason that's really important is because to understand myself as being of a kind is to understand myself as being, as I said before, one among others. I'm not identical to the others, but I am one among them. So my own understanding of myself has to go hand in hand with a plurality of others. So there are going to be others who are also persons. And the more that I want to know who I am, the more I need to relate to those others. And then together we start to address problems in the world. So there's a kind of triangle, which is a concept I borrowed from an analytic philosopher named Donald Davidson, talked about the triangle of being self-aware, aware of others, and together we're aware of the world. So this is really important because it's what allows us to find the pathway between, as I said, an individualistic view and a strong collectivist view.
I guess what you're describing there is a sort of relational quality that avoids the excesses of identity politics, right?
That's the intention, yeah. Mm-hmm, because yeah. I think where identity politics comes into the picture is when we mistakenly think that that's what defines me, that I'm a member of some group or association of some sort, whether it's my nation or my religion or my culture. And for some people, it might be a gang or a tribe. And so you do very quickly get into this notion of tribalism, which has been well discussed in the social sciences, where people start or see their identities in terms of the groups or tribes they belong to. And whilst in one sense there's nothing wrong with that, and I'm not arguing that we should not identify with various kinds of groups that matter to us. But the problem is that can go into extremes where we start, for example, to see ourselves, yes, I belong to this group and I relate to them. And so I have empathy with the members of my group. But there are others who are not members of my group. And the danger there is, and this is where identity politics gains traction, is that I then see a barrier between me and those who are not in my group. And that's where things can really get out of control. And we have extremes like, you know, gangs and tribes and cults and so on. And so you end up with negative feelings and moral attitudes toward those who are not in the group. And I think that's really important to avoid that. So one way I try to avoid it is to say, but we go back to the problem of identity. It's not my qualitative relationships or my qualitative identity which actually makes me me. And when we have that clear, I think it's kind of liberating because we realize that, okay, I do belong to certain groups, but they don't define me as a person. And quite a lot of the time, we give them up or some of these groups change whether we want them to or not. I don't lose my actual identity in that process.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and my guest this week is Lawrence Splitter, a former professor of education and philosophy and the author of Identity, Reasonableness and Being One Among Others. Lawrence has a new podcast, more details coming up. A lot of the contemporary focus, of course, on collective identity has to do with the idea that collective identity enables a kind of pattern recognition where we can discern structural injustices that are easier to miss if we just look at individuals. And a lot of our fiercest social and cultural battles at the moment are being fought precisely on this notion of the importance of seeing and naming and remedying structural injustice. Some of the key warriors in those battles would say that if we step back from a focus on collective identity, then we start losing the fight. What would your response be to that?
Yeah, well, it's a tough question, but an important one. I guess you're hinting at things like the political feuds between, you know, one side of politics and the other, the woke business and so on, right? And
yeah, critical race theory, this kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Look, again, I don't want to pretend to be an expert on all of these concepts, but this is a thought that I've had for some time. It seems to me that if you're talking about the origins of discrimination, of harm and so on, you have to talk about the fact that this often came about because people were seen or perceived as being members of certain groups, a certain kind of person, a black person, a gay person, a Jewish person, whatever. So there's no question that those kind of groupish characteristics played a role in the history, if you like, of discrimination and harm. But the real question for me is the sort of the moral one looking forward. How then should we respond to that? And this may not be to everyone's liking, but it seems to me the best way to respond looking forward is to say, well, what really matters from a moral point of view is not that you are actually a member of this or that group, but that you are a person. And so you need to be treated as a person. And the fact that you were not, with other members of your group, treated properly, therefore treated as persons in the past, is terrible. But moving forward, that's the way we need to go. Now, that's not completely discounting the various groups and so on that you feel attached to, but it does, I think, reduce the moral aspect of being in those groups. Because to me, what's important about morality is not any particular group, even a religious group or an ethnic or cultural group. It's that you are a person and that others are persons as well. And that's where morality, I believe, gets a foothold. So I guess to sum it up, historically, yes, I think we need to understand the causes of the history of oppression. But looking forward, I think we have to be careful not to get trapped in the old qualitative or tribal context.
Yeah, I see what you mean. And yet, one could respond by saying that there are certain power dynamics, certain political imperatives involved in collective identity claims that are very important and that need to be acknowledged and brought into the sphere of moral consideration. How does the recognition of personhood affect that perspective?
Yeah, well, I wish there was a simple answer to that. I mean, as I said before, I'm coming out of a particular tradition, but I have a number of colleagues involved, for example, in philosophy for children, who are very much, perhaps I won't say opposed to that tradition, but coming from different traditions, more European, continental, postmodernist, what's now called posthumanist and so on, where issues of power, for example, have been really important. And they would cite philosophers like Foucault and so on,
right,
about whom I know very little, I have to confess, and talk about, they would say of everything I've said so far, that I'm simply missing, you know, a crucial aspect of the way we interact with each other, which is that there are always going to be power dynamics. There are always going to be these power asymmetries. And I don't have a strong response to that, except to say that I think looking forward, it's really important that we imagine ourselves as persons among other persons, and we recognize those power dynamics when they're there. But I guess I'm imagining in a more ideal situation that we can move beyond them. And certainly when you're dealing with, say, young people in classrooms, that seems to me to be an ideal environment in which to do that, to try and say to kids, particularly if you have a diversity of children, and that's another issue, kids coming from different backgrounds with different ideas and so on and so forth, to get them to understand that nevertheless, their personhood depends on them seeing themselves as one among other persons, any other persons, not persons of this or that particular group.
You say that the key to fostering the kind of mutual understanding and respect that is so often lacking in our public discourse is dialogue. But when it comes to the aim of dialogue, the question of what it is we're hoping to achieve through dialogue, is it enough to say that dialogue helps us to better understand each other's points of view? Or does dialogue have a deeper purpose in your view?
Yeah. Look, this is something I've been thinking about fairly recently, actually, because I've heard various discussions about dialogue. I use the term in a sort of slightly more specialised way, but it's not just chit-chat, not just talking to each other. And clearly, as I think we'd all agree, it's not just one person getting up on a soapbox and talking to others. It's not just lecturing. It's not even just formal debating. But there is a view that at least it's talking to each other and listening to each other so that we gain a better understanding, not just of them, but of ourselves. But there are a couple of other ingredients. One is that, and this is something that I've got from my involvement in philosophy for children, dialogue, like inquiry in general, has to be what Matthew Lipman called self-correcting. Because one of the things that really damages, indeed destroys dialogue, is a feeling of absolute certainty. And you can hear this when people say, look, this is what I think. I'm really certain about this. Sure, we can have a talk about it, but I'm not going to change my mind. And at that point, I think, well, there's no way we're going to actually have a dialogue. So remaining open to rethinking one's ideas is a crucial point. But even then, I think, is not enough. I guess one could say I've thought about this more recently, even though it's an old idea. It seems to me that what we're really aiming at, depending on the kind of dialogue we're having, for example, if you have dialogue or inquiry of a scientific nature or from history or from even from philosophy, what you're trying to do, the dialogue is stimulated by certain questions and problems that puzzle us, okay, whatever they may be. And they may vary because children will have different things that puzzle them from, say, expert, you know, scientists and so on. But nevertheless, it seems to me the aim of dialogue is to actually try and reach towards the answers to those questions and the solutions to those problems. Otherwise, what are we doing if we're not aiming for that? One way to sum that up, which is rather contentious, is to say we are aiming for truth. That, I think, is a key aim of dialogue. Maybe not all dialogue, but certainly dialogue that's linked to inquiry. The aim of dialogue is to find what's true. But I think, as I just said, we have to be very careful about saying, well, now I now know what's true. So I have this little slogan that I've only just thought of recently, which is we aim at truth, but we don't proclaim it. So it may remain something which is, in a sense, forever tentative. And we know from the history of inquiry and the history of science and so on, that even when people were the most certain about what they discovered, it could turn out to be wrong. So we need to have a sort of, I don't know if it's a compromise or a balance here, that we're aiming to answer our questions and to find out what's true, but we have to be very, very careful before we proclaim, and now this is the truth. And can I just add one thing? At least I think what this does is to challenge what has become a dangerous and prevalent view around, particularly in the political realm, that there's no such thing as truth, that there's your truth and my truth, your facts and my facts, alternative facts and alternative truths and so on. I think this is a really dangerous direction to go in. And I think that can be handled, especially if we remind ourselves that we need to practice this notion of being self-corrective or reflecting. But also, there are things that we can actually rule out. That is to say, it might be easier to say that something is not true than to say that it is true. So I want to have a bit each way. I don't want to end up proclaiming what we think is true, but at the same time, I don't think we can abandon the concept of truth.
Yeah, aiming but not proclaiming. I mean, I take your point here, but it does make me wonder about the question of judgment, because it seems to me that this is an era where we have a certain problem with a chronic suspension of judgment. It sounds like a weird thing to say when everybody's just yelling at each other all the time on social media, but I guess what I'm thinking of is the way that the media, for example, endlessly treats Donald Trump as though he's a phenomenon about which we're all still making up our minds. You know, he may turn out to be the architect of a new era of fascism in the USA. He may turn out to be completely off his head, but let's wait and see. You know, and it seems to me that a certain degree of moral judgment is badly needed here, a degree of moral certainty. And it's the kind of certainty that rests on the proclamation of truth, you know, not just the aim toward truth. And I guess my question is how do you stop aiming but not proclaiming from collapsing into the kind of suspension of judgment that doesn't really get us anywhere politically?
Yeah, well, I'd prefer not to talk particularly about someone like Donald Trump. I mean, he sort of he breaks all the rules when it comes to, you know, respectful conversation, dialogue, and so on and so forth. But nevertheless, I think part of this is just the use of our language, right? I mean, in fact, when Matthew Lipman defined inquiry as a self-correcting practice, he went on to say that aims at good judgment. So the concept of judgment was always important for him, and indeed in our dialogues, we are aiming to make good judgments. Now, I guess then we could ask, well, so are judgments proclamations of truth? Well, you don't have to stress too much the notion of proclaiming, but a judgment about what is true seems to me to be fine. That is what we're aiming at. As long as we're willing, you know, as long as we say, well, this is what I now think, and indeed, since we've done it collaboratively in a community of thinkers or community of inquiry, that gives it more power. You know, this is what we now think is true. But as I like to say, there's a little voice that sits on my shoulder and whispers into my ear, yeah, but you still might be wrong. And as long as that little voice is allowed to be there, it gives us a sense of humility, intellectual humility, that falls short of saying this is the absolute and final truth. Because as soon as that notion of proclamation, you know, takes over, then dialogue becomes impossible because people are simply arguing from, you know, their own point of view, and they're not really going to listen or self-correct. And they'll see, the psychologist Jonathan Haidt talks about this, you know, one of his books, that we end up with our emotional or instinctual elephants taking over from what he calls our reasoning riders. And we think we're reasoning, but quite often what we're really doing is reasoning just in defense of those things that we really deeply feel strongly about, and we're just not going to damn well give them up. And that's something I think that we really have to be careful about. So I don't know if that kind of is a kind of answer to your question, but that's about as much as I can say at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, I have a background in religious journalism, and the word dialogue always makes me think of interfaith dialogue, which is a, you know, wonderful concept in the abstract, but in practice, it's often just a PR exercise where, you know, you have a priest and a rabbi and an imam, they all get together in a room and they say nice complimentary things about each other. And the whole thing is very polite and reassuring, and you can hardly move for all the elephants in the room that aren't being acknowledged. None of which is to say that dialogue is a waste of time, but it can often be a very effective means of not saying much, you know, ironically enough. I wonder if you think that if dialogue is to be undertaken in the service of truth, then there is a sense in which it needs to be difficult. It needs to be confronting. And yet dialogue is so often deployed to have the opposite outcome.
Sure, I think that's right. I mean, there's a certain tension, I think, in any, you know, good dialogue, and that tension is not necessarily negative or destructive. This is where things get a bit complicated, because there's a context for dialogue in which there really is disagreement. You know, there may be emotional tension, which even comes to the point of violence. And so we need to try and say, well, let's have a dialogue to try and, you know, sort of calm things down. But there's also this notion of dialogue when you're aiming to answer certain questions, and therefore what I put as aiming at truth. Can I just refer to something that I think addresses your question? You may remember a few months ago there was the a set of 20 directives or 20 steps in the Gaza, in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And I thought at the time, I looked at it, I thought this is interesting, because the first 17 or so related to trying to fix up and solve the current crisis, which was what was happening on the ground in Gaza. And, you know, whatever, I'm not talking about blame or anything at this point. I'm just saying that clearly was and still is sadly tragic and needs to be addressed. But point number 18 out of the 20 said something like, we need to set up dialogues among and between ordinary Palestinians and ordinary Israelis so that they can get rid of the single-minded narratives that they've often attach themselves to, and work toward a more mutual understanding and a way of living together. And that seems to me to be absolutely spot on. So that would be whether that's ever going to be allowed to happen. And it wouldn't just be amongst, as you mentioned before, you know, a few faith leaders here and there, a rabbi, an imam, you know, a priest and so on. I think getting people right from the communities involved together. Now, there have been some attempts at doing that, particularly before October the 7th, 2023. I know about some attempts to bring Palestinians and Israelis together. And it's quite extraordinary. They may start out very negatively toward each other. And one will say, well, look, you know, your soldiers killed my son. And the other will say, yeah, but you're terrorists, you know, killed my daughter and so on. But if it's handled correctly and if it proceeds, then a certain empathy can develop. You might even call it an empathy of shared grief or based on shared grief. And in certain situations, these people can overcome those differences and begin to see each other as persons, as I would put it, and often in some situations I know about, have become very good friends. And now, I think things have moved a long way in the last couple of years, and that's a very idealistic scenario. But it's still the kind of thing I would like to imagine. And one place where I think it's desperately needed is in schools with young people, whether it's in the Middle East or indeed even in Australia. I would love to see more genuine interfaith discussions. In other words, discussions amongst kids coming from diverse backgrounds where they can learn to talk to each other and listen to each other respectfully. And just one final point here, David, the role of the teacher here is really crucial because it's not just going to happen by itself and there'll be lots of barriers to overcome. So you need someone who really understands what they're trying to do, which is first of all, build an environment of respect, right, where people feel safe among each other, safe enough to be able to speak fairly candidly. Secondly, they need to understand the procedures, as I call them, the procedures of good thinking, of inquiry. When is it appropriate to give reasons, to ask questions, et cetera, et cetera? What assumptions are we making? And then we need to be clear about what is our content? What are we talking about? And I use that sort of little framework when I'm working in philosophy for children, but I think it applies in all sorts of different fields. And in particular, I think it also applies when you have this really, this area of enormous contention in the social, cultural, and religious spheres. If you have someone who can facilitate, not one of my favorite words, but to really manage that kind of dialogue, then I believe we could get a long way. And I would just like to think that wherever things are going with the current discussion about hate speech and hate groups and so on, that we can find a way for all our children, particularly children, because they're going to be the future, okay, but adults as well, to learn how to talk to each other across their various differences.
Well, this is a conversation, a dialogue that I've enjoyed very much, Lawrence. Can we finish up with a plug for your podcast? You have a new podcast, The Rest is Uncertain. What's it about and how did it come about?
Yes, it's actually quite a nice coincidence of timing. I've been working on a podcast. May I just say that the origins of this, about 18 months ago, I did some podcasting with teenagers and we had a couple of sessions that went really well. And then I proposed continuing to do that, talking about a very contentious but powerful series that was on TV from Britain called Adolescence.
Oh, yeah.
And I wanted, and I said, look, teenagers want to talk about these kinds of issues, you know, social media, gender relationships, et cetera, et cetera. But I got negative feedback particularly from school leaders and parents saying, oh, we think our kids are, this is too sensitive for our kids and so on. And this is another point, if I may say so, from made by Jonathan Haidt in his latest book called The Anxious Generations, which had a big influence on our government's recent laws about getting young people off social media. And he argued that it's a kind of weird juxtaposition. We think we're protecting kids by saying, well, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that. You can't walk to school by yourself or you can't play in that playground. But in fact, for many years, we completely ignored the most toxic environment in which they were engaged without necessarily our knowledge, which was social media. And I think the same thing is kind of going on with this little example I just gave. We often think that we protect young people by not allowing them to engage in certain kinds of discourse or whatever, but actually we're not. We're leaving them vulnerable. And so I'm really very big on the idea that we need to engage young people in dialogue. So that's one of the themes of this podcast, which, by the way, is now going to be called The Rest is Uncertain, at the intersection of philosophy and public life. So it's partly about the virtues of dialogue, and I weigh into some issues which I think are important, such as the housing crisis, issues of youth crime, and issues to do with schooling and education. But I try and have a sort of thread in the background there, which makes it a bit more philosophical. And that thread is one that we touched on earlier, which is how do we see ourselves in terms of being individuals who care for ourselves and perhaps those closest to us versus being part of something bigger, and what is that bigger thing?
Lawrence Splitter, former Professor of Education and Philosophy at the Education University of Hong Kong, one of the pioneers of philosophy in schools in Australia and recently turned podcast host. And as you just heard, that podcast is The Rest is Uncertain at the intersection of philosophy and public life. And you can find it on whichever podcast platform you happen to use. And that's it from the Philosopher's Zone for another week. If you're not following our podcast yet, then you should definitely be doing something about that. Subscribe via ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll never have to go looking for us again. We're also online, where you can find details about all of our guests and streaming audio of several years' worth of past programs. It's a vast and precious archive. Go to the ABC Radio National homepage and look for the Philosopher's Zone on the program menu. This program is produced by me, David Rutledge, on Bundjalung land. It's been great to have you along this week, and I hope you can join me next time. See you then.